You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, our guest is Dave Goldberg. Dave teaches at Drexel, where he is the Associate Dean for Research and Graduate Studies in Science and Director of Undergraduate Studies, and a regular contributor to IO9, which you should check out because it's really cool. His first book was A User's Guide to the Universe. Now he's written The Universe in the Rearview Mirror, which was published in hardback last year and is out in paperback by Plume, the publisher, just last month. The Universe in the Rearview Mirror is a study in symmetry, which really is a corollary to a study of the entire universe from soup to nuts. And speaking of soup to nuts, the entire book, including the title, is also a study of metaphor, of analog, and simile. Because unless you are a rocket scientist or well-versed in mathematics, your understanding of the universe, as I think Einstein said, must perforce be somewhat, if not completely, limited. And even though I can intuit stuff, I can't read a proof, which is why this book is so cool. So through metaphor, such as those surrounding the Higgs boson, we regular people, because of Dave's book, can form a mental image of how we think things work. Not a really good image, but at least something. And Dave comes up with some really good metaphors. In addition, he contributes a great deal of self-deprecating humor, cultural references, pop and otherwise, like comparing real science to what we're exposed to in movies like The Matrix or X-Men or The Hulk or Star Trek, and some of which he is happy to say is good science and some is really bad. And my favorite bad science section is when Dave lampoons Dan Brown, who's such a pain in the ass anyway. And The Da Vinci Code is like an Archie comic compared to Foucault's Pendulum by Umberto Eco. But I digress. Anyway, if three or four of your heroes are Albert Einstein, Max Planck, Richard Feynman, Isaac Asimov, Lewis Carroll, you're going to love this book as well. So anyway, I told you you're going to have to shut me up. So Dave, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for that marvelous introduction.
You're welcome. So tell us why you are writing for geeks like us, even though you're kind of geeky, who unfortunately aren't as smart as you. What's the gut feeling that makes you want to do this?
Well, I don't know that it's a hierarchy of intelligence, but you know, you said in your introduction, you know, how much we talk about metaphor. And one of the great things about learning about science is you realize, okay, you can master equations very, very quickly, but until you really understand what those equations mean, you're not really getting at the meat of what the science is. I mean, my personal heroes, people like Richard Feynman and Albert Einstein, what made them so great wasn't just that they had these amazing ideas, is that they had a mind that could sort of delve into it and sort of really understand what it was getting at. And oftentimes that means you can really get into sort of simpler examples. So one of my hopes with this book isn't just like that I'm going to give you some perception of understanding about the universe, but that you're really going to understand it as somebody who studied it would understand it. You won't have the equations, but you'll get the core concept. You know, and as to why, well, I mean, besides the fact I think it's awesome to understand as deeply as we can how the universe works, the bigger thing is, why do we do basic science? Why do we have scientists running around making discoveries and learning all these things about the universe? It's great to produce technology, but we can't just be a priesthood. We can't just be going and calculating all of these things without telling the rest of the world what it is we've discovered, because otherwise, you know, what's the point of it all?
Yeah, but you know, it's funny, and let's for our listeners who want to figure out what this book is about, first of all, if we talk about the Higgs boson, for example,
sure,
and you get really upset when people call it the God particle, which is also a metaphor, but not one you like. So talk about the metaphor, or the analog, really, of the crowded room and the celebrity walking in.
Sure, this was an idea it won some major award in the UK for sort of the best way of describing the Higgs boson. So first let me just take a step back and remind your listeners what it is, why the Higgs boson was such a big deal, what it is that it does. So as you may recall, in 2012 there was a huge amount of excitement because it was the discovery of this particle at the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland and France called the Higgs boson. and very, very massive thing, 130 times the mass of a proton, which is itself a pretty meaty particle. And it's one that we'd been expecting for a long time. And physicists have this beautiful picture of the universe that's made up of all of these different fundamental particles, and there was exactly one particle we hadn't yet discovered, and that was the Higgs, and now we've discovered it, and we have this beautiful theory that describes all manner of phenomena. But the thing that makes the Higgs boson really, really special and really captures the attention of people sort of very non-intuitively is the Higgs boson, or really what's called the Higgs field, gives mass to other particles. And what that means is sort of naturally we expect most particles to be massless. And if you don't have a picture of what that is, light, photons, the thing that makes up ordinary light that we can see with our eyes, those are massless particles. They're flying around all the time, and massless particles, pretty much by definition, travel at the speed of light. Anything with mass, that means your protons and your neutrons that make up your atoms and the electrons, they all travel less than the speed of light. Now, we know of some massless particles, but most particles have mass. And in our theories, we say, everything should be massless, at least naturally. So the idea of the Higgs is it somehow gives mass to everything. Now, the somehow is a part that we sort of have to sweep under the rug a lot of times, because getting back to your original comments, that's the sort of thing where it's like, oh, we'll just give an analogy. I can give you a little bit of a feel for how all of this fits together before I get into one analogy or another, which is the Higgs gives mass to particles because it gives energy to particles. And so Einstein's great equation, I mean, Einstein comes in almost every one of these discussions, Einstein's great equation was E equals mc squared, which is to say that any particle with mass also contains a fair amount of energy. C is the speed of light, and it's a very big number, which means even something with a very, very small mass is going to have a great deal of energy, even if it's just sitting there. But the opposite holds true. If you have some energy of interaction, from that energy, bang, you create mass. Okay, so that's the very, very sort of nuts and bolts interaction part of it. But that's still not going to give you a sense of why these sorts of things work. So one of the big metaphors that people use, they say, okay, that's fine, but how does it really work? Well, what distinguishes a particle that has mass from one that doesn't have mass? Well, particles that have mass are hard to move. That's the definition of mass. So, for example, what people think about is, imagine you have this celebrity walking through a room, a very crowded room. Now, the celebrity, if the room were completely empty, the celebrity could just fly through, no problem. But as soon as someone who's very, very famous enters a room, people start to crowd around her, and makes it very, very difficult for her to move. And every step she takes, more people sort of collect around her. And the people collecting around her, the fans, that's supposed to be this thing called the Higgs field. And so they all crowd around her, it makes it difficult for her to move, and therefore it's like the Higgs field giving rise to the mass of a particle. But the deeper you think about it, like, that's not a great metaphor, because it doesn't tell you why some things have mass and why other things don't have mass. It actually doesn't describe mass very, very well at all. Not to get, throw out too many physics concepts right off the bat, but one of the other, besides E equals mc squared, one of the most famous concepts in physics that has captured the popular attention are Newton's laws of motion. And so most people have heard this saying, objects in motion stay in motion, objects at rest stay at rest. Well, this celebrity walking through the room, having the people crowd around her, will be moving along and will slowly come to a rest in this picture. Right? That's screwed up. That's not how things really work. When you have a massive thing like a proton or an electron, those things always have mass. They're hard to get moving, but once they get moving, they're not slowing down unless something actively slows it down. And so the Higgs field doesn't work that way. So the Higgs, I must say, you brought up right from the bat this idea of the Higgs. The Higgs is one of the most difficult conceptual ideas to think about, because it really doesn't have any analog, and it really is totally contrary to our natural intuition. We think of things like the mass of a particle or the mass of a body as being something that's really, really, really just intrinsic, something that a body has or doesn't have. But it turns out it arises out of these processes all the time. And I'll leave you with in this discussion with one sort of fun fact that's related to mass. We tend to think of mass as being intrinsic to a body, but and we also think of now in the popular imagining, we think of the Higgs as being responsible for all the mass in the universe. That's not true. It turns out the Higgs creates mass not directly for our protons and neutrons that make us up, but there are these quarks, little tiny microscopic particles, there's three of them in every proton and neutron. And if you add up the masses of the quarks inside a proton or neutron, it only adds up to about 1 or 2% of the total masses of the protons and neutrons. And since the protons and neutrons make up your mass, that means this Higgs stuff only makes up about 1 or 2% of the mass of you. The rest of that 98% of your mass doesn't come from the Higgs at all. It comes from the fact that you've got particles, subatomic particles, flying around so energetically inside the nuclei of your atoms that they create virtually all of your mass, essentially yeah. just out of energy.
I had to go back and read that page again.
Well, it's just incredible.
I did. You know, it's the funny thing. Look how enthusiastic you are about this. I mean, you love this stuff. And, you know, the one thing I think Higgs said, it was like, which is like so funny that he said, you know, this summer I discovered something completely useless. And it's like, it's so funny that that's the way science works. And then it's like, since you wrote the book, all of a sudden the Higgs boson, now they say, well, we can't exist because the Higgs boson isn't what we thought it would be. And if it's the way we think it is now, the universe should never have come into being. And it's all like Feynman's castling analogy on the chessboard thing. It's like all of a sudden you guys changed your mind. Now we can't exist again.
Well, I wouldn't quite go that far. I mean, actually, in a lot of ways, the further discoveries of the Higgs have been kind of mundane. And people were expecting things to be a lot stranger, hoping, I think, that things were going to be a lot stranger than they might be. Because you come up with a model, and we check things, and we do experiments on these giant accelerators. And what you really hope is that you're going to find something so incredibly unexpected that we just go off into an entirely new branch of science, that we discover something that really sets us off on an exciting path.
Well, it's funny, though, you know, when you were talking about quarks and we talk about metaphor. So in quarks or spin, when you're talking about quarks, you're talking about up, down, strange, charmed. These metaphors, these words, even the word quark, which comes from James Joyce Ulysses, how do those metaphors translate? Because all you're doing is arbitrarily saying up, down, and spin really isn't spin, and left-handed universe really isn't a left-handed universe.
Oh, sure.
Well, is it? No, you already explained that. Why is it a left-handed universe, then?
Well, I'll do you one better. Let's go one more basic than that. So,
okay.
and one that I think most of your listeners are probably a little bit more familiar with, which is electric charge. So we encounter electric charge in our high school physics classes, physical science classes, and familiar with the basic idea, opposite charges attract, like charges repel one another. And that seems simple enough. The nuclei of atoms, hydrogen, helium, and so forth, are made of protons, and protons have a positive charge, and electrons have a negative charge. Again, that seems perfectly unambiguous. The one has plus, the other has minus. But why do we choose which one's plus and which one's minus? I mean, after all, if I have a plus charge and a minus charge, they attract. And if I switch which one's plus and which one's minus, they still attract. If I have two negative charges, they'll repel one another. If I switch those negatives to pluses, they're still the same as one another, and they repel one another. The only reason we call electrons negative and protons positive is because of Benjamin Franklin. He came up with the convention. I forget the exact details. It was basically, he decided that when you strip off charges using a piece of amber, that the charge that you were removing was the negative. That was his determination, and it was totally arbitrary. And if he'd picked the opposite, if he decided that it was positive, everything would have worked exactly the same. All of our equations would have worked exactly the same. So, I mean, we've got, I mean, obviously there are things we call spin, you know, and we call a charmedness of quarks or upness of quarks. Those things are arbitrary, but even things that we think of as being sort of hard and fast rules of what the notation should be, those things are arbitrary, the charge of ordinary particles. But one of the things that's very remarkable, I mean, this leads into the whole question, this leads into the basic idea of the book, because which one's positive and which one's negative doesn't matter, it turns out that that basically extends to essentially all of our laws of physics. If you take every single charge in the universe and take all the pluses and turn them into minuses and all the minuses and turn them into pluses, you would never know the difference. And that may seem like total science fiction, like, well, I mean, clearly it's not something that we're capable of doing, but there exist particles that are exactly the same as our ordinary things, exactly the same as our electrons, but as instead of having a negative charge, have a positive charge, and they're called positrons.
And that's right, and that's how, when you lead into Lewis Carroll and Alice in Wonderland, which is a great metaphor, because that's exactly what happens, you know, when you look into the mirror, you know, you're seeing this same thing, except it's a negative instead of a positive charge.
Well, exactly right. Well, yeah, or it's left versus right.
Right.
Exactly right. I mean, you look into a mirror, everything's reflected. The person who looks like you is if you happen to be right-handed, is left-handed in the mirror, but they seem like a perfectly reasonable human being. Everything seems like it's physically well-motivated. So, you know, it gets to a very deep question, right? I mean, if ordinary matter and so-called antimatter, the same except for flipping the charges, are exactly the same, then why are we made of the one and not the other? Why are we made of ordinary matter and not antimatter? I mean, antimatter is a real thing. It's not just sci-fi. We can make it in a lab all the time. But it doesn't dominate in our world. It doesn't, obviously, the one thing that's very famous about antimatter is if you encounter your antimatter twin, shake their hands, boom, you both blow up and are converted into pure energy. And that doesn't happen on Earth. All the people are made of matter, and the Earth is made of matter, and all the rest of the planets in the solar system, and everything in our galaxy, and everything in all the galaxies, as near as we can tell that we can see, all seem to be made of ordinary matter. So why did matter win and antimatter lose? We really, at this point, do not actually have an answer to that.
Well, isn't it, I mean, what you learn in other books that are written so that people like me can understand science is that, you know, at the beginning, 10 to the negative whatever, that there was almost an equal amount of each. There was a slightly more matter than antimatter. Everything is annihilated, and all that's left is whatever matter was left over.
Oh, sure. I mean, and of course, I bring this up as well, but it doesn't actually answer the question now, does it?
I don't know.
It doesn't tell you. So in the beginning, and the beginning for this purpose turns out to be about 10 to the minus 35 seconds after the Big Bang.
That's the number I was going to say. Damn it.
very, very, very. I mean, it's such a ridiculously small number that it may as well be zero, but it's important that it's not zero. So some ridiculously small time after the Big Bang, there was, for every billion or so antiparticles, there was a billion and one, roughly, ordinary particles. And you're exactly right. The billion annihilated with the billion, and it left the one. And so,
We're here.
There's a tiny offset, and that left us with ordinary matter. But that doesn't really answer the question, because we haven't been able to produce that sort of disparity between matter and antimatter in a lab. Now, we have seen a few differences, but they're very, very subtle. I mean, they're along the lines of, I'm going to, go a little bit deep here, that there are particles called neutrinos. I mean, these are actually quite abundant in the universe, except for particles of light. They're the most abundant things out there. But they interact so weakly that a neutrino can travel through a light year's worth of lead without interacting with anything. They're very difficult to actually see. And even though the sun produces about as many of them as it does photons, particles of light, and obviously the sun is easy to see in ordinary light, in order to detect even a few neutrinos, we need to build these giant swimming pool-sized detectors underneath the Earth. And even so, we only detect a few a day. So neutrinos are tough to measure, But we can learn a fair amount about them. And one of the things that's very strange, neutrinos, like many, many particles, are spinning. And the details of spin are not that important. You can sort of imagine it kind of like a top. And every neutrino that gets created is created in such a way that if you take your left hand and you point your thumb and say, that's the direction the neutrino is traveling, and take the rest of your fingers and curl them, that's the direction the neutrino is spinning. So the thumb is the way it's traveling, the finger is the way that it's spinning. And every antineutrino is exactly the opposite. We see neutrinos are left-handed, antineutrinos are right-handed. Well, and like that's the difference between antimatter and matter, to a very good approximation.
So if I visualize that as my world universe view, then you go back to what it was in the 1800s or before, even to the Greeks, of an atom kind of being a solar system. Mm-hmm. And we had, when I was a kid, that's what we were taught, that that's the way it worked. And now that metaphor, that analogy is completely obliterated.
Although it's worth noting that unless you have a ridiculously youthful voice for your age, that even then we knew it was wrong. I mean, I was taught the same thing, and that's not how the solar system really is. But yeah, no, it's a very good approximation. Sure, you can think of an electron traveling around a nucleus, kind of like a planet going around the sun, but that's not really how it is. It's actually more like a cloud, we learn. And this cloud is due to what's called quantum uncertainty, and it becomes much more complicated.
Well, if you talk about Heisenberg and the uncertainty principle, or Schrodinger's cat, which actually is a great analogy, because like that one you can kind of really understand. But if you're talking about these things, I was thinking, actually, I'm looking at the VU meters on the board now, which are analog, because you can see the line going up and down. Mm-hmm. And I remember when cars for like 2 or 3 years had those digital speedometers, and then they went away. And the reason why is people like analog. I mean, you don't know where an electron is if you know how fast it's going.
That's right.
And you don't know how fast it's going if you know where it is. But people like to know where they've been and where they're going. So I think they like speedometers because they like to see, okay, I was going 30, now I'm going 35, now I'm going this way. And they don't want to know exactly where they are at any given time. They don't know exactly how fast they're going. It's like the tuning knob on your...
Oh, I see. They like the, so they've got plausible deniability if they're pulled over by the cops?
I got pulled over today. He gave me a warning. But I don't know why. But anyway, so, yeah, like a radio. You know how you can tune... Now you have to tune exactly to 102.7. Before, in the old days, you could tune in between them and actually pick up a station. Now you don't have that luxury anymore. People like analog.
Well, that's true. And, I mean, it's a very interesting point because, of course... The universe doesn't have to, and generally doesn't accord with what we'd like, right? It's our intuition about the natural world is generally set up in such a way that our caveman forebears would have found it useful. You know, our eyes, for example, are attuned to the light that they're attuned to because we can hunt particular animals in the daylight, and we get the light from the sun and are sensitive to that. But, you know, there's plenty of other light that we don't see. We're attuned to things that speeds at 15 miles an hour or 20 miles an hour, but we're not. We have no idea intuitively what happens at 99% the speed of light, even though lots of interesting stuff happens there. And likewise, we're attuned to things that seem certain, right? You know, you feel like if you throw a ball and you have perfect aim, that there's such a thing as perfect aim, that you can predict exactly where a ball will go or what have you. But you're quite right. I mean, there is something, and so in that sense, we kind of like the idea of things being digital because we like the idea of things being sort of exactly predictable. But we do really live in an analog world.
That's the question. I was thinking maybe I can ask you a question that hasn't been asked you on a book tour. And the question is, or maybe it's just a question that can't be asked, do we live in an analog universe or do we live in a digital universe?
That is a very interesting question. I mean, there's actually a very real sense in which we live in a digital one. There are a very, very large but still finite number of states within any given volume of the universe. You know, there's a discussion in my book about some calculations done by the physicist Max Tegmark. And one of the things that he does is he talks about within the horizon. And horizon in cosmology basically means the distance that in principle we could see since the beginning of time. It's a finite distance. It's, you know, pretty far. It's 40 billion light years or something like that. But it's still finite. And within that volume, he talks about sort of the number of different configurations that the universe can have. Now, if we live in an analog universe where you could have any possible value, you might say, oh, well, you could have one universe that's exactly one configuration and then move a single atom, you know, a millionth of an angstrom to the right, and then that's in a different universe and so on.
True.
And what quantum mechanics says, actually, no, because of quantum uncertainty, those two universes are indistinguishable from one another.
Yeah, but if you start with the slit experiment and go forward from that, and you go to the point where by the very observation of anything we've altered its state, then I'm screwed completely. I don't know what the hell's going on. I mean, I know as soon as I look at something, I've changed it because I've looked at it, and then you go to the weak anthropic and the strong anthropic principle. I'm totally, you know, I'm just one of your geeks reading this. But I can't wrap, and no one can, but I can't wrap my head around all this because I know if I look at something, I'm changing its very nature.
But you bring up an excellent point. So the double slit experiment, which let me just briefly describe.
Yeah, go ahead, do that.
So the idea is you can do this with light, ordinary photons. You take a laser beam, basically, and you shine it at a piece of cardboard with two little slits etched into it. And, you know, if we think about this in a purely classical way, if we think about this as, like, you come upon a fence with two holes in it, and I throw, say, a snowball or whatever at that fence, the snowballs are going to go through either the left hole in the fence or the right hole in the fence, and if they make mark on a wall behind it, they're going to make basically two splatters, one to the left and one to the right. That's sort of the classical view of things. The double slit experiment, you can do with, as I say, you can do this with light, you can do this with electrons. If you have basically fine enough equipment, you could do it with neutrons. You can do it with all sorts of particles. But let's just think about it with ordinary laser light. You shine it at these two slits, and basically what you end up getting is an interference pattern, not just two projections of the light, but basically many, many of them, bright spots and then dark spots and then bright spots and then dark spots, much like when you throw two stones into a pond,
right.
You can see sort of an endless array of ripples where in some places the ripples from one stone interact with the ripples from the other, and they add up to an extra high wave or an extra low trough. Or sometimes they basically cancel one another. But you get many, many, many of them. So when you get this infinite pattern, it ends up being an indicator of wave phenomenon. Well, one of the things that's very strange about this experiment, and it's one of the great experiments in quantum mechanics, is you can do all sorts of things to screw it up. So for example, if you have a little detector right on either side of one of the slits, where you could say, oh, the photon is going through the left slit or the right slit, and you can determine it with certainty, all of a sudden this wave-like phenomenon, this interference, goes away. And in fact, there's all sorts of variance about it. And it seems as though measuring the experiment really does fundamentally change it. But if you're not measuring it like that, if you're not directly detecting which slit the photon or the electron goes through, then in some sense, each individual photon is uncertain. It literally goes through both at once and could be said to interfere with itself. Just this remarkable, remarkable result. And you'll hear it described sometimes as things like electrons and photons being both waves and particles both at once. So this is this incredible result, and you know you and I are discussing this, and you know again this incredible idea, and you're saying well, but you know we can affect it and it changes the universe, but the remarkable thing is if we're talking about an individual photon and we actually go through and measure it, in some sense that is the ultimate digital universe, because if it goes through the left slit, that's a zero, for example. If it goes through the right slit, that's a one. Like, there are only particular states the thing can actually be measured in. And that's the thing that's so remarkable. And so the entire universe is made up of sort of not an infinite, but just a very, very large array of all these things where ultimately you can be in one state or you can be in the other.
Yeah, but, you know, well, we're talking about this big blob of everything's a metaphor. We're talking about this big blob of stuff now, and part of that big blob of stuff that I was alluding to is the fact that there's so many variants that could have made it so that we don't exist.
Oh, sure.
And so since we exist, the universe exists. The universe exists because we're here to observe it, and that's the anthropic principle. But you talk about it and fundamentally, but it's always seemed to me to be the most logical thing because there's so many, I don't even know, if ice was heavier than water, it would melt, it would fall to the bottom and all the fish would die and then we wouldn't be here.
Oh, sure.
I mean, there's so many different things, but we are here. And so, empirically, that's why the universe is.
Right. So we're sort of, there's two different things we're talking about, right? One is, the universe is what it is, and you and I could get together, and we could put on our fancy white lab coats, and we can do an experiment in the lab, and the way that the experiment comes out, there's uncertainty. But, you know, that's pretty low stakes. But it may be that the laws of physics themselves had some uncertainty. We don't know, by the way. We don't know whether the laws of the universe were sort of hardwired in and had to be the way they were, or whether the laws of the universe, you know, your example is, for example, what the density of ice is compared to water, but a lot of people think about things like the strength of electrical force,
right,
or the mass of the electron or whatever. If those numbers, you know, those numbers, we don't know whether they're hardwired in or whether they're just something that just happened to be the way they are, but you're absolutely right that, you know, small changes in those could have meant that we don't exist. That not only just we don't exist, but no complex chemistry might occur, and therefore nobody exists. And it may be, and this is, you know, to sort of extend, this isn't even a metaphor, this is just what people think, to extend the idea just a little bit further. It may be that the universe got to roll the dice lots and lots of times and lots of places, and it's only in the parts of the universe where the dice came up, we'll call it snake eyes, happened to be particularly lucky. I know snake eyes is unlucky if you're actually playing craps, but where the universe happened to come up particularly lucky, that you got the numbers just right to be able to have the physics to be just right, to produce complex chemistry, to produce all the other things that arise so that you and I could be having this conversation right now.
Well, listen to this. I have two friends. They're both very, very intelligent. They're both fundamentalist Christians. So we have these discussions, and I said, so Chris, you actually believe that the world was created 4,000 years ago and God put the fossils there to test our faith? I said, you're such an intelligent person, I can't believe that you believe this. And he goes, well, Sam, you're such an intelligent person, I can't believe that you don't. And then our argument ends. And so if you're saying, what they're arguing is that science is just as much of a religion as their religion, that you have this basic faith, this prime mover, that leads to all your other conclusions. I mean, you and I know they're wrong, but they're, you know, it's, you know what I mean?
Well, it's funny, right? I mean, you correctly have ascertained, you know, no, I am a very big believer in a physically based universe. But one of the things that's actually very difficult, I mean, we can talk about what we do and don't know about the universe. But remember, when we talk about things like what the strength of the electrical force is and that we don't yet know the answer to that, and that's a concession of our ignorance. And I think it's dangerous when physicists claim that, or any scientist claims that we know something that we don't yet know. But at the same time, I think the great advantage to science is that we're able to say, okay, we've come up with this model, but having come up with this model, we are now able to make very quantitative, very specific predictions about things that have not yet occurred. Now, one of the crazy things about our universe, one of the surprising things about our universe, is that part of the nature of our predictions, because of this whole thing of the uncertainty principle in quantum mechanics, is that there is a random component in the universe. But even then, we can make quantitative predictions. We can say, we can do this particular experiment, and we should get this particular result. 13% of the time, and this other result 28% of the time, and so forth. And we can predict that very, very accurately, very, very precisely. Do the experiment and get the result right. And if not, we can track it down. And I think that so the onus on science, on sort of a naturalist interpretation of the universe, is not to say we need to be able to have predicted how everything was going to turn out from first principles. But to say, look, if we have a model for the universe, we should be able to predict what happens next. Now, one other point. You know, there's this idea that you should be able to prove, if I have some model of the universe, that I should be able to prove that my model of the universe is right. But of course, we know that that is not just a very high standard, but that's actually impossible. It's impossible to demand that someone prove that their version of the universe is right. At best, and what good science will do, is that they provide you the opportunity to prove it's wrong. If I have a theory of gravity, and in my theory of gravity, things float upwards rather than falling toward the Earth, you do the experiment. You take a ball, you let it go, it falls toward the Earth. My theory must have been wrong. And it's disproven, and we move on. And, you know, obviously at this point our models are much more complicated than that. I think the issue is not that we will ever get to the point where we will definitively prove that some combination of the standard model of particle physics and evolution and every other theory you care to combine is going to be proven definitively right. It will just have failed to be proven wrong.
Well, it's funny because in your book you talk about, jokingly, and it's really... because I had the discussions too, and you did too, you know, you're in your dorm room late at night, you're in either a minor or major altered state of consciousness, and you're talking with your buddies, and you're talking about, like, in Men in Black, what if we're really just in a locker at the airport, and, you know, that's the world, or we open the locker door, and there's the real universe. And it's funny, because those dorm room discussions, even though you kind of make light of them, and I do too, they really get to the same questions we're talking about right now. They always have.
Oh, sure. Sure. And I mean, some of them we have the answers to, and some of them we don't. Right? I mean, that's going to be the first step in anything. It's going to be addressing the sort of questions, addressing the things you don't understand. I think, as I say, it's sort of hubris to say that we have all of the answers, but I think that, you know, there's definitely an attitude that certain people, and I don't even want to sort of pick a fight with people who have a religious view of the universe. I mean, they're certainly allowed to have their views of things. But rather I'd like to take an issue with people who sort of take skepticism as some point of pride, where they sort of feel like, oh, well, just because I don't believe everything that I'm told, you know, that sort of makes me a deeper thinker. And actually, that is a situation where I have much more of an issue, because at the end of the day, you're not asked to accept our modern view of physics because you're told. You're asked to accept it because it hasn't been disproven yet. The sort of next level of inquiry is what questions are satisfactorily answered so far, but where you can come up with a next level of question where our models may not be able to address it. I mean, that's where things really become interesting. You say, okay, well, we've proven this, but what happens if we go to a factor of 100 higher in energy? Will prospect A happen, or will prospect B happen? Those end up being the really deep questions. And those include things like we've already gotten to. Like, where did the laws of physics come from? They were handed down from us, and again, a big theme of my book is they have all these beautifully symmetric properties. We've already talked about matter and antimatter, for example, or left versus right. But why those?
Why do they break, too?
And why do they break? And why are they structured in this particular way?
But look, here's a hybrid. This is a hybrid in between the two. Okay, as you say in your book, and as pretty much... Not to be condescending, it sounds condescending. Every popular book about science says, Einstein said, God doesn't play dice with the universe.
Sure, it's a cliche. I'm embarrassed.
No. It belonged there. But the thing about it is, okay, we're talking about fundamentalist Christians. We're talking about us. So Einstein's talking about God, and he's talking about quantum mechanics, which he hated, and he's saying God doesn't play dice. Well, so there's the middle. There's the middle somehow. He's your hero. He's my hero. So what did that mean? What about spooky action at a distance? I mean,
this turned out to be, but you know, so Einstein was talking specifically about some predictions of quantum mechanics. But the thing about him was, Einstein actually was exactly the right case, because what he kept doing was he kept coming up with thought experiments. Let me just put this in some context again for the listeners. So, despite the fact that Einstein played a very pivotal role in developing quantum mechanics in the early 20th century, he never really liked its implications. And there's all sorts of weird things about quantum mechanics. And I'll give just one simple, not so simple example. The idea of what's known as entanglement. And so the idea is, we've already talked about this idea of spin. You have particles that are sort of spinning along. And exactly what spin means is a topic perhaps for later in the conversation. But you can think of it as you would if you threw a football and it spirals in a particular direction. And in fact, you could imagine, for simplicity, if we have two people and they stand back to back and they each throw a football in opposite directions, those two footballs are going to spiral in opposite directions, right? If we both throw with our right hand, or equivalently, if we both throw with our left hand, they're going to spin in such a way that their spins cancel out, you can think of it. Now, we have particles that work that way. They start off, these particles called pions, they start off, they have no spin at all. They decay into two other particles, and they've got two particles flying off with opposite direction spins. But because there's quantum mechanics involved, the direction of either one of those spins has sort of a randomness to it. And all you really know is that the spin of one and the spin of the other must exactly cancel one another. But, you know, as they're flying away from each other, they're getting further and further apart. And if I go and I measure the spin of my particle and you're millions of light years away or even just a few feet away, apparently the measuring of my particle, because yours has to be exactly opposite, equal and opposite, my measuring it apparently affects yours.
Okay, so, stop. Okay, because if that's true, and he called a spooky action a distance, he didn't like it. But if I turn something here, and 3 million light years away, something turns the opposite way.
You're cheating.
Okay, you talk about Earth. I don't care if the listeners understand any of this anymore. Okay, so if you're talking about the Ansible, and you're talking about Ursula Le Guin, and what you're saying is, what could be happening is that information is transmitted instantaneously. Because if you turn, it turns the other way. So he didn't like it.
You've cheated and put words into my mouth. So let me correct you here. So there's you're describing two different things. One is I've measured something over which I have no control. And the other, and that's the one you're saying, is I've taken my particle and I've twisted it. And I've chosen that it's going to be spin pointed in the northern direction or the upward direction or something like that, and therefore yours must be in the downward direction. Those are not the same thing. If I just measure it, it might be up, it might be down. But I'm not in control over that. The moment you take your particle and turn it, decohered it is sort of a fancy word for it. You've basically broken the system. So you can't communicate that way. But what you can do is basically, but if I measure mine as up, I have the knowledge that yours is down. Like, that's it. That's as far as that goes. So this is a very, very standard misconception that people have. They think, oh well, but you know, if we know that my particle and your particle are sort of equal and opposite spins, then if I measure mine, yours must be the opposite, therefore I can use that as a communication device. But the truth of it is you can't. Any more than if you and I each reach, so let's imagine we reach into a bag with two marbles, one black, one white. You reach in your bag, you put it in your hand, you don't look. We walk 20 paces away from each other, we each look at our marble, you look down, and you see that your marble is white. You didn't control it. You didn't know that it was going to be white. You couldn't make it be white. But you look down and see your marble is white. You know, therefore, that my marble is black. Right? That's much more like what it is, except for the fact that there's this whole random part of it. I mean, Einstein actually thought that it was very much like the marble example, and he thought, well, you know, the only way we're going to get around all of this is if there really is, if there really is basically a something very classical, like just something hidden, what's called hidden variables. But there isn't any way in which some sort of wave is propagating faster than the speed of light. That's just impossible.
But you still are able to have the knowledge. So now we're dealing with metaphysics.
Right, but the thing is, so Einstein came up with thought experiment after thought experiment where he said, look, if you do this, if you do this particular combination of measurements and so on with particles, then this will show that in fact, there is no information. There's nothing that's being transmitted. There's no wave functions collapsing. It's just something hidden, something you didn't know about, just like the marbles. And it turns out Einstein was wrong in this respect. I mean, he made a very definite set of predictions. It was put into mathematical formalism, set of predictions by a fellow by the name of John Bell in, I believe, the 1960s. And it wasn't until the 1980s that we were actually able to test all of these ideas that Einstein argued against so strongly and so intelligently.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter that Einstein's thoughts were well motivated. They turned out to be experimentally predictable, and he turned out to be wrong in this case.
All scientists like being wrong. But the thing about it is that he's way smarter than.
You can pick anyone you like.
He's way smarter than you, and he's way, 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 way to the 10 to the negative 35th smarter than me. Well, that would be 35th. But in any event, he still called it spooky.
Oh, sure.
Well, why did he call it spooky then?
Well, I mean, I think that was his choice. I mean, he had a flair for the melodramatic,
yeah.
I think.
But you know what I really like about Einstein being wrong is when he said the cosmological constant was the worst mistake he'd ever made in his life.
Sure. And that took an enormous amount of intellectual honesty. So, you know, this idea was, you know,
but he was kind of right, though.
Well, see, people like to give him a lot of credit.
Because of dark matter and dark energy.
So Einstein had, like, should have won about 15 different Nobel Prizes. But for many physicists, including me, one of his greatest accomplishments was what's called his theory of general relativity, his theory of gravity. And this is an idea you probably have heard of, about how space and time are bent. It turns out to have all sorts of really cool predictions, like the time is running slightly slower near the surface of the Earth than it is in deep space. He predicted ultimately black holes got predicted from this theory and so forth. So incredibly, incredibly powerful. But the prevailing idea at the time was that the universe should be static, should be infinite. And Einstein realized, you know, if he works out the implications of his theory, that the most natural thing in the world is if you start off with a universe where all the galaxies are just sitting there, they're going to attract one another and fall into a point. So Einstein realized, oh, you know, my equations have this little extra bit of freedom. There's actually an additional number you can throw in there. If for those of your listeners who've taken calculus, it's exactly the same as when you do an integral, and you realize, if you add an extra constant to your integral, that also works. So it's literally no more complicated than that. Einstein did his integral, and he's like, oh, you know, that constant doesn't have to be zero, it can be something. And he tried to fine-tune that something to exactly counter the gravity of the universe, the collapsing gravity of the universe, so that the galaxies would all sit there indefinitely. And then, you know, some 10 years later, Edwin Hubble said, no, actually, the universe is expanding. Your so-called cosmological constant doesn't exist. Einstein, to his great credit, I mean, it was a little bit, his first attempt, admittedly, was not the greatest scientific rigor that ever was, but Einstein, to his great credit, I mean, he loved that Hubble was able to discover this. He was so full of admiration, and that speaks to your point of Einstein not just occasionally being wrong, but being quite magnanimous when he's wrong. And then, sort of in a second reversal, in I believe 1998, we started observing the most distant galaxies out there, and it turned out on large scales or at late times, the universe has something like an anti-gravity. These days we tend to call it the cosmological constant, or sometimes dark energy. And it basically is this thing that causes the universe to not just expand over time, but accelerate. And the discoverers won, very rightly, the Nobel Prize in physics for it. And it shows up in the equation, or can show up in these equations, exactly the way that Einstein thought, but in a very, very different way. So he sort of predicted it. He predicted that such a thing could exist,
right.
But putting in that value was sort of, not intellectually lazy, but certainly cheating when he tried to introduce it.
Well, when you go back to the beginning of the discussion, and when anyone talks about the fabric of the universe, which in of itself is an amazing leap that you think of fabric. So if you talk about the fabric of the universe, I'm so locked into the idea of this rubber sheet and a bowling ball going around and around, that I could never get out of that metaphor. But what if that metaphor is completely wrong? Or what if I'm looking at it wrong? What if that's not what it is? You guys have forced me to take a rubber sheet and a bowling ball and make that the universe.
That's fair.
Isn't that weird?
That is weird, and you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, there's a dozen different analogies that we use. So the idea that a black hole is very much like a rubber sheet and you just take a bowling ball and it makes everything sort of incredibly curved around it and everything wants to fall in, or the other, you know, another one that's very similar is you take a balloon and you paint a bunch of galaxies on it and you blow up the balloon and the galaxies get further and further and further apart. And, you know, obviously there are some flaws with that analogy. Although, I must say, as analogies go, these ones aren't bad.
Okay, well, I was going to do this today. What if I gave you an analogy, and then you had to correlate it to the universe? So, like, here's
okay,
a good one.
Okay, give it a shot.
Okay, so these fishermen go out in their little rowboat, and they find this whole amazing lot of fish, and they're so, so happy. So they don't want to lose the place where the fish are, so they paint an X on the side of the boat. And then they go back home. All right, so now you got to figure out what would that apply to.
Oh, do you have something in mind? Or
no, you have to figure out, like, there's got to be something that scientists do or that people believe.
Oh, I mean, there's something very much like that. I can cheat a little bit with this, but actually this goes to Einstein's theory of what's known as special relativity. So, I mean, this is the one that comes to my mind. Undoubtedly, other people might have other ideas, but we tend to think in the universe, we tend to think when we think about the universe, it's sort of like there are absolute places in the universe that, you know, I'm here and you're there and we can mark everything off, and if we concentrate hard enough, we might find grid lines sort of running through the universe to identify individual places. But that's not true. It turns out that there is no absolute state of motion of the universe, and there's no absolute places in the universe. So if instead of a fisherman, we imagine a spaceship, right? I could be flying through some region of space, and I could do the exact same thing and mark something on my ship at a point that I like and then keep on flying. And the point is, you know, from my perspective, because there's no distinction between being in an absolute state of rest or an absolute state of motion, as long as it's at constant speed, we may as well say that, oh, I stood still, but those fish swam away.
Huh.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, that spot is still where the X is, but the fish, and if you're in a real ocean, the ocean all moved. And, you know, again, as long as everything's moving at a constant speed and direction, something that will not, in fact, be the case in a real ocean, obviously, then what you're saying is perfectly legitimate. That,
well,
you know,
yeah,
there's just no absolute space, there's no absolute time.
Well, even like yesterday, I'm on a train, you know, I'm stopped. No, I'm stopped.
You can't even say with certainty.
Yeah, I can't remember which one it was. But that's, I mean, that, I'm proving it myself, empirically.
When
myself,
there's a train next to you,
yeah,
right? You can't tell whether the train next to you is moving or whether you're sitting still, provided you started up slowly enough. That's exactly right. I mean, if you're sufficiently egotistical and you look out the window, you wake up from a nap, you look out the window, you see a mountain range moving past you, you know, if you think the world revolves around you, you're like, oh, well, I guess I guess somebody must have painted the scenes of some mountains outside the train and are just running it backwards. Like, that is a physically legitimate thing to say. I mean, until, of course, you come to a stop, right? You can tell with absolute certainty if you're being accelerated or decelerated, because you get pushed into into the back of your seat, for example, when you're accelerating, and if you stop abruptly, you fly forward.
Well, unless you're in the middle of a plane ride, and then you could be stationary. The other thing is, if you're sufficiently solipsistic, which I am. So when I was a little kid, when I went to bed, I thought that my mother and father took the universe apart and, you know, everything got dismantled. And then before I woke up in the morning, they put it all back together again.
Sure.
Going back
this is this whole idea of object permanence, right, that the little kids are supposed to develop, when they're two or three, right, whenever it is. That sure, like, you know, when you're not looking, the universe just doesn't exist. Absolutely.
Right. Well, that's basically the strong anthropic principle.
But the point of special relativity is that there are certain ways in which you are perfectly free to select yourself as being the center of the universe. And indeed, when you really start looking at it very deeply, it turns out that there's no well-defined center of the universe. So it turns out often to be mathematically convenient to just pretend you're at the center of the universe.
Well, Dave, I could go on and on and talk to you about this stuff, and we're back in the dorm room again. You know, those dorm room discussions used to go on for 6 or 7 hours.
But sure, we'll order our Domino's pizza.
But I can't do it here, so I wanted to thank you so much for joining us today. It's a great book. And, you know, you could come out to our bookstore and do a book signing, because we're really literally 35 minutes from your office right now.
I'd love it.
Okay.
That'd be great.
We'll do
thank
that.
You so much for having me.
You're welcome. Okay, so that was Dave Goldberg talking to us about the universe in the rearview mirror. We talked so long that I actually ended the show, and then we talked for a bunch more. So if you ever do subscribe to our YouTube channel or the podcast on iTunes, you can hear us talking and blabbing and being geeky for like another 15, 20 minutes. So it's a great book. For those of you who really aren't mathematically inclined, it's the best way to get a clear understanding of where we are in terms of knowing how the universe started, what the universe is made of, and where we'll be or not be billions of years from now when entropy kind of makes us into this cold, dark cinder of a universe. So, in any event, I'm really glad to be able to interview all these science guys. I know it's a far cry from some of the fiction people I've been interviewing, but to me, it's my favorite thing, so hopefully you like it too. Next week, we haven't scheduled yet. We have a whole bunch of people in mind. We've been scheduling a lot of people who have written books that it's like a new genre of like immigration novels, people who write about coming to America and what that experience has been like. So it may very well be one of those, because I got like 3 or 4 of those lined up and ready to go. So anyway, thanks as always. This was my favorite interview ever, I think, just because it's exactly what I think about all the time, every day, waking up. So let's talk next week on here, The Avid Reader, and thanks so much for listening.
You've been listening to The Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.